Home Group is the New Horizons group of beautiful Bend, Oregon. And we meet 7 days a week currently on the Zoom platform. I pretty much qualified in all of that last week, so I'm not going to do that every week. I'm just going to get into it this week. I didn't get through the forewords, which was what I was hoping to do last week. Hopefully that's not going to become a thing. I'm going to go real quick over just a couple of things I don't want to miss in the forewords, and we'll dive right into step one. Okay. So, it's hard for me because my book is a study edition. So let's see, we're on the forward to the second edition. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 pages into the forward to the second edition. It starts talking about, and why this is in the forward to the second edition is because when the forward to the first edition came out, obviously we didn't have the 12 traditions. I don't want to give the impression, I would love to dive into step one right now, but I don't want to give the impression that a big book study should leave out the traditions. And so the traditions are in the back of the book, appendix one, in the short form and the long form, but also when we wrote the forward to the second edition, because this book was published, the second edition was published in 1955. So we had already had the traditions for 5 years. So now in the forward to the second edition, it's going to explain why the traditions, right? And the last line of the first paragraph on that page that I just mentioned says, we had to unify our fellowship or pass off the scene. That is the reason why we have the traditions. So, okay, how do we unify? Well, as we discovered the principles by which the individual alcoholic could live, the 12 steps, right? We had to evolve a set of spiritual principles by which the AA groups and AA as a whole could survive and function effectively. Now, you guys that are taking notes, here we go. We're going to go through these quick. So keep up with me if you can. It was thought that no alcoholic man or woman could be excluded from our society. Tradition 3, that our leaders might serve but never govern. Tradition 2, that our groups, that each group was to be autonomous. Tradition 4, and that there was no professional class of therapy. Tradition 8, that there were no fees or dues or expenses, or our expenses were met by our own voluntary contributions. Tradition 7, there was to be the least possible organization, even in our service centers. Tradition 9, our public relation was to be based on attraction rather than promotion. It was decided that all members ought to be anonymous at the level of press, radio, TV, and films. Tradition 11, and then finally tradition 10, and in no circumstances should we give endorsements, make out alliances, or enter into public controversy, which kind of also is tradition 6 a little bit too. So those are some of the 12 traditions that we're being introduced to in this book. And then at the very end of that page, it says, while the internal difficulties of our adolescent period, my highlight is adolescent period. Bill calls those first 10 years in Alcoholics Anonymous before we adopted the 12 traditions, a few things. One, he calls them the adolescent period. Another, he calls them the flying blind period, right? And we talked about that last week with kind of the rails to run on, kind of the traditions being the yellow lines in the middle of the road, the street signs that say, slow down, there's a big corner ahead, right? So so now we're going to go to the forward to the third edition. I don't want to get too far behind. Let's go to the forward to the fourth edition. So this is on page XIX, if you are in the study edition. And if you're not in the study edition, I don't know what page that's on, but it's the forward to the fourth edition. So the third paragraph down starts out, as the message of recovery has reached larger numbers of people, it has also touched the lives of a vastly greater variety of suffering alcoholics. When the phrase, we are people who would who normally would not mix, page 17 of this book, was written in 1939. It referred to a fellowship composed largely of men and a few women with quite similar social, ethnic, and economic backgrounds. Like so much of AA's basic text, those words have proved to be far more visionary than the founding members could have ever imagined. This means more today, I think, than ever before in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous because of this pandemic and the situation that we're in right now. The stories added to this edition represent a membership whose characteristics of age, gender, race, and culture have widened and have deepened to encompass virtually everyone the first 100 members could have hoped to reach. Now, this is my highlight. While our literature has preserved the integrity of the AA message, I love that definition and explanation of why we have the literature. Like I talked about last week, that game of telephone, it might have worked for those first few years, for the lean years, for the flying blind period, but that game of telephone, just passing on how I remember my sponsor passing it on, would have not worked for 85 years. It would be so convoluted after 90 years that we wouldn't even know what the original message of Alcoholics Anonymous was. And so how important is the literature? Well, it preserves the integrity of the AA message. And that is super important to me because I know that this memory, it's not going to preserve the integrity of the AA message. So I'm so grateful that they wrote it down and they published it in this volume. So while the literature has preserved the integrity of the AA message, sweeping changes in society as a whole are reflected in new customs and practices. Highlight those two words, underline them, circle them, like customs and practices. Because that's already talking about tradition four, okay? Tradition four grants each group autonomy where their customs and practices are concerned. We will not be talking about this later on. customs and practices. I'm so used to doing tradition workshops that I'm like, okay, I got to get back in the big book. So customs and practices are what every group is autonomous, not their own traditions, not their own set of steps. Each group does not get to choose to make up their own set of steps or their own set of traditions. Those are not what each group gets to choose. Each group gets to choose their own customs and practices. Taking advantage of technology, technical advances, for example, AA members with computers can participate in meetings online, sharing with fellow alcoholics across the country or around the world. How prolific is this writing, you guys? In any meeting, anywhere, AAs share their experience, strength, and hope with each other in order to stay sober and help other alcoholics. Modem to modem or face to face, AAs speak the language of the heart in all its power and simplicity. How beautiful is that, considering that was written 20 years ago? Like, no, way more. Yeah, 20 years ago. That's pretty beautiful. So doctor's opinion. This is where when I'm taking the women that I sponsor through the steps, we go through the doctor's opinion first. The doctor's opinion and step 12, as outlined in chapter 7 are pretty much the exact same chapter, just coming at it from two different ways, right? Because step 12, all of step 12 is someone else's step one, right? And all my step one is someone else 12-stepping me and showing me this stuff. So I love how the first, and this is in the, so a little more history for those of you who didn't realize that the first edition of the big book, the doctor's opinion was actually page one. That was page one. And then we didn't have traditions back then, right? And so not only just alcoholics didn't participate in AA, anybody could participate. The doctor was considered whatever. But now that we have traditions, when they published the second edition, Well, we realize that only an alcoholic can help another alcoholic. And Dr. Silkworth, who wrote The Doctor's Opinion, is not an alcoholic. So he couldn't be part of our first 164 pages, which is the program of action, which is the directions, because everything in that first 164 pages was written by alcoholics, for alcoholics, by alcoholics. So that's why now, now that we have the traditions, it's in the it's in Roman numerals. So your book probably will say XXV. Mine says XXI. We of Alcoholics Anonymous believe that the reader will be interested in the medical estimate of the plan of recovery described in this book. Convincing testimony must surely come from the medical men who have had experience. So basically what this is saying, and I'm not going to read every page and everything to you guys, but what this is saying is, nobody's going to want your solution without knowing first, what is the matter with me? I'm not going to trust what's going to work for a solution unless I know what my problem is. Like, what the heck is the matter with me? I can't stop drinking. Why is that? Like, I don't understand. I have baseboard day cleaning day every week. Like, I've never been late on a single bill in my life. I've never been late for, you know, why can't I just have one beer? Like, what, this doesn't make sense to me. Well, the doctor's opinion is to put some things, kind of connect the dots, you know, and describe to me what it is I have. And I love the doctor's opinion because, you guys, I don't know if you're like me and you were, AA wasn't your first stop, but I had been to a lot of doctors and I've had a lot of doctors' opinions. And it wasn't until I read Dr. Silkworth's opinion that I went, oh my God, it's me. I have been diagnosed with everything under the sun. And I have tried all of the self-help programs and I have tried all of the books and I've tried all of the medical experiments and nothing worked until this doctor who wrote this long before I was even born. I read it and the whole time I was like, oh my God, that explains everything, which is so super cool. So that's why it's in the front of the book. Even though it's not page one, we left it where it belongs, in the front of the book before any of the solution. So let's see, I'm going to go to, well, first I'll go over my highlights on that first page. So the paragraph that starts out in 1934, four lines down from that paragraph, it says, was an alcoholic of a type. Dr. Silkworth is talking about an alcoholic of a type I had come to regard as hopeless. So he's talking about the alcoholic of the hopeless variety. I have alcoholic of a type highlighted because you will see for the next 103 pages, well, for the first 44 pages, at least, it talks about a specific type of alcoholic. It's not going to just talk about an alcoholic. It's not going to talk about, you know, a problem drinker, a heavy drinker. It's going to talk about either the alcoholic of the hopeless variety or the alcoholic of our type or the real alcoholic, because there's a lot of people who get physically dependent on alcohol. Not just 10% of the world who are alcoholic. Like, if you drink every single day, you're going to get physically dependent on alcohol, right? That doesn't make somebody alcoholic. And we'll get to that on page 21. But the doctor also specifies that, like, you can't drink your way into being an alcoholic. You can use your way into any addiction, and anybody can become addicted to alcohol if they drink enough of it. You'd think it's an addictive substance, but that's not the alcoholic of our type. That's the alcoholic that once they get off, then programs like Chic Chadel, and Clancy used to talk about Chic Chadel a lot. And I had a sponsee whose husband actually shipped her off to Chic Chadel. It's a eversion therapy, right? And the only one left that's legal in the United States is in Texas, of course. That's where she went. And her husband expected her to come back fixed, because some people, not alcoholics, some problem drinkers, some heavy drinkers get fixed from overdosing on alcohol for 10 days straight. I'll tell you what, if that fixed me, I would have been fixed a long time ago, because I have overdosed on alcohol for 10 days straight, without the help of a doctor. And they have, you know, in that program, it works. They have alumni, like, you know, some people are able to go get fixed at Chic Chadel and come back and never drink again or drink with impunity. They just don't get addicted to alcohol again. That's great. Not for the real alcoholic. So this is covering a specific type of drinker, the type with an allergy. So this man, in the course of his third experiment, he acquired certain ideas concerning people's means of recovery. This is the doctor. As part of his rehabilitation, he commenced to present his conceptions to other alcoholics, impressing upon them that they must do still like with still others. This has become the basis of a rapidly growing fellowship of these men and women, of these men and their families. This man and over 100 others have appeared to have recovered. So this was talking about, you know, after Silkworth talked to Bill, Bill started this give it away to keep it program, right? Commencing to present his conceptions to other alcoholics, which is basically the whole foundation of our entire fellowship. And then at the bottom, it says, I personally know scores of cases who were of the type. Here's another highlight of the type with whom other methods had failed completely. That's the real alcoholic. I'm of the type that would go to Chic Chadel, get overdosed on alcohol, think I'm fixed, and then be exactly the same. Like without a spiritual solution, nothing fixes me. I'm hopeless. I'm the alcoholic of the hopeless variety. So the next page, XXVI for the regular big books. The physician, sorry, who at our request gave us this letter had been kind enough to enlarge upon his views in another statement, which follows. In this statement, he confirms that we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. So there's two different parts of this thing. I'm not going to call it a disease because the literature doesn't call it a disease. If you want to call it a disease, great, more power to you. This illness has two parts to it. Obviously it has a third part too. When we get there, we don't mention it before the second step because the literature doesn't. But this disease, this illness has two different parts. And I believe that that's why the first step, even on the short form that we read off the wall, it has a hyphen, and it's the we're powerless over alcohol, and our lives had become unmanageable. So I have to think neck up, neck down. Okay, so the body of the alcoholic, neck down, right? Not mental, neck down. I have a physical allergy. And that means, and I'm going to show you the rest of this chapter plus chapter one plus more about alcoholism is going to reiterate the next 2 minutes of what I'm about to say over and over and over and over and over and over and over again until you guys are sick of it. So the body of the alcoholic, neck down, is the physical allergy. It means once I take a drink, and the definition of an allergy is an abnormal reaction to a food or substance. That's what it was in 1935 when this book was written, 1935, 4 years before this book was written, is an abnormal reaction to a food or substance. I have an abnormal reaction to alcohol because when I ingest alcohol, I get thirsty. I don't get quenched. The average person, 90% of our society, ingests alcohol. And it does for them what alcohol should do. It gives us this sense of ease and comfort. And then they go, oh, it worked. And they can finish their dinner and brush their teeth and, you know, tuck their kids into bed and go to bed. And then they even get up and go to work the next morning, you know. And the abnormal reaction to alcohol that I have is I ingest alcohol and it's on. And there's no off switch. And I cannot tell you if I'm going to go to work or not the next morning. And that is an abnormal reaction. So that's bodily. And it's bodily and mentally different from our fellows, right? That's bodily, neck down, body. And then the mind, the mental obsession, and that's where I get craving. And I don't know if you guys have heard people in meetings, like newcomers mainly with 90 days sober or whatever. And they're like, oh my gosh, my craving is so bad today. I was craving a drink so bad. Nope, 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 nope. It was the mental obsession that you're talking about, not a craving. The craving only happens after we ingest alcohol. That's a physical craving. You don't get a physical craving until after you ingest the alcohol. And it's going to explain this a ton in this chapter. The mental obsession is what precedes, in Silkworth's words, the first drink. So the mental obsession is what precedes the first drink. Bodily, physical allergy, and mentally, obsession of the mind. Physical allergy, neck down, craving, neck down, obsession, neck up, right? So what is the problem with why it, who cares, right? Who cares? I don't care about the problem. I want the solution, right? Like this is all semantics. Who cares if the newcomer says craving instead of allergy or craving instead of obsession? Like, what does that even matter, right? Well, I'll tell you what it matters. The reason why there's 44 pages plus an additional 9 pages of the doctor's opinion dedicated to this specific difference between the physical allergy and the mental obsession is because half measures avail us nothing and half of a first step is doomed to failure. And I'll tell you what, I've worked with women who understand that physical allergy 100%. They ask me to sponsor them and I start taking them through this work and they're like, oh no, I get the physical allergy. Once I start drinking, I can't stop. I can't have so much as one drink whatsoever for the rest of my life. I get that. And they're so convinced, right, that the steps, do we really take the steps like dying man? Because you're so convinced. Like if I was allergic to a strawberry, I would just stay away from the strawberries. It's like, okay, I am never going to eat that strawberry again. Right? Because I understand the allergy. With a strawberry or with a peanut allergy, there isn't a mental obsession that comes with it. It is a one-fold thing. So I don't go down to the ice cream shop and go, oh, maybe if I just have a strawberry milkshake, maybe if it's just strawberry flavoring, like I don't obsess over it, right? I'm like, well, I can't eat peanut butter sandwiches, but maybe a peanut butter cup once a, you know, I don't obsess. I don't obsess over my other allergies. So those people end up eventually maybe not doing the steps thoroughly because they don't think that they're going to die. They don't understand the mental obsession and they end up drinking. On the other hand, I've worked with women who don't really buy into the physical allergies, like allergy. I don't know. I don't break out in hives. I know what it's like to be allergic to juniper. I can have these eyes are watering and blah, blah, blah. That doesn't happen to me when I drink. So, okay. But I know that I continue drinking. I have this obsession with drinking. I can't even go down the cheese aisle because it shares the aisle. So please, I need the steps. And so it's like, okay, let's go through the steps. They do take the steps. They recover. Their obsession is lifted. And then it's like one day it's like, oh my gosh, my obsession is lifted. I haven't even thought about drinking in so long. I'm sure one drink won't hurt because I'm no longer obsessed with alcohol, right? Because they've never understood the physical allergy. They never understood that one drink is too many and 1,000 is never enough. And that's why 44 pages plus the doctor's opinion is dedicated to both of these. So the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal of his mind. And now at the bottom of that paragraph, Dr. Silkworth tells us flat out how we're supposed to qualify in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. He gives very clear-cut directions here. Any picture, and this is in the last line of this paragraph, any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out this physical factor is incomplete. I was at a meeting with a woman who... I sponsor her today. I was at a meeting with this woman about 6 or 7 years ago, and the way this women's meeting works is it's a great women's meeting because they study the literature, but in the first 5 minutes, if there's a newcomer in the room, somebody in their first, second or third AA meeting ever, or maybe it's the first 30 days, whatever, they pause on what they were going to study. And they ask somebody from the floor to qualify, right? for the first step. Her entire qualification was that when she knew that she knows she was a real alcoholic, because when she was 8 years old, her neighbor girl came over to the house to play and she didn't call first. And she ended up beating up the neighborhood girl because she was restless, irritable, and discontent. And she could not control her anger because she didn't call first and she didn't ask her mom and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, oh, no, that is not, that has nothing to do with alcoholism. Like nothing. Like, we all have human character defects. The difference between the alcoholic is that those are the dubious luxuries of normal men, right? For us, we drink, and to drink is to die. But everybody in the whole planet has, I mean, there's a lot of people who have inferiority complexes with egomaniacs that are not alcoholic. Like, that is not how I'm going to help a newcomer to qualify with alcoholism, right? That's not how they're going to identify. Anybody can identify with that. And maybe some alcoholics can't identify with that, right? I mean, I know that I have my best friend. She's not an alcoholic, and she has some of the worst road rage in the world. And I've never had road rage ever. Like, I'm super, like, if we both are at the four-way, you know, I'm like, oh, go ahead. No, you go ahead. You know, I'm totally. And so when I was new and I came in and I heard about the alcoholic road rage and all this stuff, I'm like, oh, I don't have road rage. That's not alcoholism. Okay. That's humanism. I don't recover from humanism either, by the way. I can try. But so any picture of the alcoholic, which leaves out the physical factor, the allergy, the once I take a drink, I get more thirsty, is incomplete. The next line, the doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol interests us. And it's because that newcomer can identify, they can, that magic of me too, like, oh, that explains it. That it's not my willpower. It's not weak will. It's not a moral thing. It's really like, it's, I'm bodily different from other people. And we need that, right? And so now at the bottom of page XXVII, the next page, in my book, it's something different, but I wrote down, I translated all these so that I could stay on focus. So at the bottom of the page, it says, of course, an alcoholic ought to be freed from his physical craving for liquor. So it's talking about craving is something physical, not mental. Craving for liquor and often requires a definite hospital procedure before psychological methods can be of maximum service, can be of maximum benefit. So that's saying that, you know, in order for an alcoholic to actually start really, you know, taking the steps, they might need to be physically free of that physical craving first, that you might need to go to detox. You might need to go to, you know, and that craving really only happens after you take the first drink. So whatever, 5 to 7 days after the drink, there is no more craving. Now you're left with the mental obsession, the crux of the problem, right? So we believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is this is my highlight, manifestation of an allergy. The phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. Never occurs in the average temperate drinker. So when you're going through this work with a prospect and they're like, well, you know, yes, sometimes I get drunk and I don't mean to. Sometimes I can't, I don't know, like, yeah, I go out with some friends after work and I plan to have two and then I just change my mind. Oh, you change your mind? So do you change your mind and have one? No. Oh, you change your mind and have more than two? It's like, no, nobody's ever changed their mind and then we're going to have two and then decided to have one. That's not ever the way the mind changing goes, for one. But then when they say, well, sometimes I am able to have just two. Oh, really? Yeah, actually like half the time. Okay, well, let's focus on the other half, because the average temperate drinker, this phenomenon of craving never happens in the average temperate drinker. It uses the word never, not sometimes, So sorry to fill up your loophole there, buddy, but the average, you know, that, so that's that, the, and this whole, the first 44 pages and the doctor's opinion is designed to close up their loopholes, right? Is designed to close the loopholes so that the alcoholic can't still feel different and talk their way out of alcoholism, right? And that's the first loophole closing. This is the first page actually that I go to with a newcomer when we sit down to qualify. This page, page 21 and page 44 are the qualifying pages that will help the new person to understand if they're alcoholic or not alcoholic. These allergic type can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. You'll hear a lot of big book thumpers. I'm going to look at the numbers because I'm going to like drop off like 10 people right now when I say this. You'll hear a lot of loophole finding big book thumpers who don't believe in singleness of purpose and think a drug is a drug is a drug, say that in any form at all, they love to quote that. That means, you know, dry alcohol, alcohol in pill or powder form. I'm here to tell you that there's no such thing as alcohol in pill or powder form. That's called drugs. and there's a place in there's a place in AA literature, and I'll get it, that goes over the type of alcohol in any form at all. And it lists liqueur, wine, beer, vanilla extract, and it lists, because of all of these loophole finders and all of these people who want to be way more inclusive than just to the alcoholic. Now for me in my sponsorship line, I require an honest sobriety date, right? We don't self-medicate. But that's not what this sentence is speaking to. And let's not pretend. We're going to read the black this next few weeks, not the white. We're going to leave the white alone. So, frothy emotional appeal. The beginning of the next sentence says frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. The beginning of the next paragraph, sorry. Frothy emotional appeal. What is frothy emotional appeal? I was taught that frothy emotional appeal is your daughter, for example, saying, "Why do you always choose alcohol over me?" Your family saying, "Again? You're doing this again? You said you were done drinking." Your doctor and your probation officer and the, you know, "You're going to kill yourself. Why are you continuing to drink?" And people pleading with you and begging you to stop. So basically an intervention would be frothy emotional appeal. And sometimes it might plant the seed. Sometimes an intervention might get the ball rolling. But ultimately, frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. The message that can hold these, the message which can interest and hold these alcoholic people must have depth and weight. And that means that identification, that magic of me too, only an alcoholic saying, "I can't stop drinking once I start." And you're like, "That's me. How did you know that about me?" So that's a good, the very bottom of that page, they are restless, irritable, and discontented. And unless they can experience that sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few first drinks. You know, I don't know about you guys, but I could experience that sense of ease and comfort before I even took a drink. So weird. When I used to work out of the house, I had a job that was, I had to be a morning person, and I am not a morning person today, but I was a morning person, and I was like the morning person, right? I get to work, I'm holding coffees coming in, and I got coffees for everybody, and I'm, "Good morning, sunshine, you know, here's a coffee." And everybody knows that Carrie's a bright and early morning person. And then come one or two, and I don't know it. I don't know I'm getting restless, irritable, and discontent. I don't know those words. I don't know that terminology. I call it bitchy, right? I start getting bitchy. And everybody around me knows that, "Oh, Carrie's getting bitchy," you know? And I'm getting short with people. And like at my work, I'm like, not fun to be around anymore. So my day has an expiration date. So if they're sending somebody home early, it's going to be me, right? And I'm like, good, I deserve to go home early, right? And I get out in my car and I know what white knuckling it is because I literally hold my steering wheel so tight that I can see my knuckles are turning white. I know where that phrase comes from. And I'm so tight and I'm just can't breathe. My shoulders are tense and I get out of the parking lot and I can kind of start to breathe, right? And I drive home and I pull in the driveway and my shoulders drop. And I know there's a six pack in the fridge. And I walk up the door and I go into the fridge and I get a beer out or I pour myself a drink. And I can take a deep breath and I can breathe. And I sit it there on the counter while I start dinner or start doing the dishes. And I don't even need to take a drink of it. And I get that sense of ease and comfort. And I don't know if anybody can identify with that, but that is definitely my experience. After they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and we're talking about after they have succumbed, right? And the phenomenon of craving develops. And again, this is in context. So the phenomenon of craving only comes after we take that first drink. The craving is only physical. So after they have succumbed and the craving develops, they pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. This circle eight is what I call it. This is repeated over and over and over again. And unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there is very little hope of his recovery. On the other hand, as strange as this may seem to those who do not understand, including people who've been sitting in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous for 30 years, once a psychic change has occurred, because all we hear over and over again is we never have control, right? We never regain control. Once a psychic change has occurred, the very same person who seems doomed, who has had so many problems that he despaired of ever solving them, suddenly finds himself easily able to control his desire for alcohol. The only effort necessary being that required to follow a few simple rules. Obviously, the rules is what Dr. Silkworth is calling our steps. and then I've also heard the simple rules, the simplicity of the rules are what Dr. Bob refers to as, you know, once we go through this process and once we recover from alcoholism, then the few simple rules that we're required to follow once that obsession has been lifted is trust God, clean house, and help others, baby. It's that easy, that simple, right? Keep it simple. So then at the bottom of that page, let's skip to the bottom of that page. And I do not hold with those who believe that alcoholism is entirely a problem of mental control. He's going to reiterate the whole physical allergy again. I have had many men who, for example, worked a period of months on some problem or business deal, which was to be settled on by a certain date favorably to them. They took a drink or so prior to the date. And then, right? And then the phenomenon of craving at once became paramount because the craving always comes after that first drink to all other interests so that the important appointment was not met. These men were not drinking to escape. Now, because of the phenomenon of craving, they were drinking to overcome a craving beyond their mental control. So that's saying the physical, the mental obsession always comes first. And then once we take that first drink, we're no longer drinking, you know, to escape. We're no longer drinking because he just left me. We're no longer drinking because I just lost the job. We're no longer drinking because, well, even F it drinkers, you know, even drinkers who go out because F it. We're no longer drinking because F it. We're no longer drinking because of a loss of somebody, you know, a loss of a job, a loss of a loved one. Now we're drinking after we take that first drink to overcome a craving beyond my mental control. It's physical now. So then we're going to go through those types of alcoholics. They're going to present these types of alcoholics. And I love how Joe and Charlie put 1 through 5. So it says the classification of an alcoholic is most difficult in much detail is outside of the scope of this book. There are type 1, of course, the psychopaths who are emotionally unstable. We're all familiar with this type. They're always going on the wagon for keeps. I was this. They are over remorseful and make many resolutions, but never a decision, right? And unfortunately, this is a program of action, not a program of intent. type 2, there's a type of man who is unwilling to admit that he cannot take a drink. He plans various ways of drinking. He changes his brand or his environment. And then type 3, there's a type who always believes that after being entirely free from alcohol for a period of time, he can take a drink without danger. That's the type I was talking about of why you got to grasp both sides of this first step. There's the manic depressive type who is perhaps the least understood by his friends and about whom a whole chapter could be written. Type 5, they're the type entirely normal in every aspect, except in the effect alcohol has upon them. They're often perfect. They're often able, intelligent, friendly people. That type is reiterated throughout the entire book. It starts on page 7. If you guys want to flip to page 7 real quick, in Bill's story, right smack dab in the middle of the page, doesn't get much more in the middle. Bill's talking about, it relieved me somewhat to learn that in alcoholics, the will is amazingly weakened when it comes to combating liquor, though it often remains strong in other respects. Like me, I had a baseboard day. My willpower was great, just not so when it comes to combating liquor, you know? And then we go to page 26. Page 26 says it again at about 11 lines up from the bottom of the page. He's often perfectly sensible and well-balanced concerning everything except, you guessed it, liquor. And this is what helped me so much, because when I first got to AA, I couldn't swallow the step 2, the insanity of step 2. I couldn't swallow the part of step 2 that says we'll restore us to sanity, because I think insanity in what I see on TV, what I imagine in the mental institutions. And some of us get there, obviously, but I did not. And I didn't chew on my sleeves. I didn't drool. I wasn't put in a padded room or a straitjacket. And so I'm like, I know I have a drinking problem in step 1. I get it. I'm powerless over alcohol. But now you want me to swallow an even bigger pill. You want me to admit that I am insane? And my sponsor luckily knew where all these pages were. And she took me here and she goes, no, no. Insane when it comes to liquor, alcoholic insanity, which is what they call it throughout the book, alcoholic insanity. And then so often perfectly sensible and well-balanced concerning everything except liquor. And then we go to page 26 and it says it again, about 12 lines up from the bottom of the page. He seemed quite rational and well-balanced with respect to other problems, yet had no control whatever over alcohol, right? Page 38, I mean, we could go on forever on this, but I'll just give you one more. About 12 lines up from the bottom of the page. However intelligent we may have been in other respects where alcohol had been involved, we've been strangely insane, right? I mean, and it goes on, and I just won't take up more time on that. But what I'm saying is this type 5 is very common, and it should be, if you're working with someone who can't swallow that whole insanity pill because they haven't been thrown in a insane asylum, you know, this might be a good idea to bring them to these places. So all of these, and they're talking about all of those types that we just read, right? And many others. Here's the qualifying factor. Here's the magic paragraph. All of these and many others have one symptom in common. Not 5, not 3, not even 2. One symptom in common. They can't start drinking without developing the phenomenon of craving. They're not all egomaniacs. They don't all have an inferiority complex. We don't all have road rage. We have one symptom in common. Cannot start drinking without developing that phenomenon of craving. This phenomenon, as we've suggested, may be the manifestation of an allergy, which differentiates these people and sets them apart as a distinct entity. So for somebody like me who came in looking to be the Fruit Loop in the bowl of Cheerios, right? I want to stand out. I want to be unique. I had a big, you know, I could never just be an alcoholic. I had to be an alcoholic and something else, right? Always. Whether it was a grateful alcoholic or a recovering alcoholic or an alcoholic addict or a recovered alcoholic, like it always had to be something different, right? This is an opportunity for me to be unique. I have an allergy which separates me and differentiates me as a distinct entity. What's cool about that is that's what binds me with you guys, our common peril. That is our connection, that we all have an allergy to this one substance that will ruin my life. So, all right, looking at the time, moving on, trying to get to, let's go to Bill's story. There's a few things. First of all, page 7, right? I mean, because we just went through that and I love this. So first, let's go to page 6, actually. Mind and body, mind and body, mind and body. I mean, you guys can use this like I love going through Bill's story and more about alcoholism with a highlighter. And one of the things that I suggest to, you know, when you get a newcomer, you know, when you get a new sponsee and they want homework and I'm like, I don't give homework. It's like, we go through this work and we do, you know, we go through this book and we do what it says and we pray where it says to pray and they still want homework. It's like, okay, how about this? Where's Waldo game, right? Go through and find all the places that it talks about the twofold, right? Mind and body. Well, the first one, and I'll just give you guys a couple to start you out. The first one is on page 6. The last paragraph on page 6 starts out the mind and body. Then 4 lines down from the bottom of the page, physical and mental, which is the same thing as mind and body. About 8 lines down from the top of page 7, mental and physical. 4 lines down from that, bodily and mentally. And that goes on. And it's cool because during the whole first 44 pages and the doctor's opinion, whenever there's one, they say the other. And it's because half measures avail us nothing, right? I need to know that I'm bodily and mentally different from my fellows. Now, I'm not spiritually different than non-alcoholics, for you who say it's a threefold disease, which I believe it is threefold, but the third fold is not, I am not unique. That is not unique to alcoholics. That, you know, that does not qualify anyone as an alcoholic because we, you know, there's a lot of people who are not in fit spiritual condition. They have a spiritual disease that are not alcoholic. And one of the reasons I know that is because we have 200 different 12-step fellowships, right? Like, there's a lot of different people who are spiritually sick. That's not unique to the alcoholic. What's unique to the alcoholic is we can't drink alcohol, right? Because we're allergic. And then we have this mental obsession that says, drink, 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 even though we know we're allergic, which is insane. So for me, it's a mental and physical, twofold, mental and physical, with a spiritual solution. With a spiritual solution. The solution is what's spiritual. There's nothing spiritual about sickness anyway. It relieved me somewhat to learn, and we already read that part. It relieved me somewhat to learn that in alcoholics, the will is amazingly weakened when it comes to combating liquor, though it often remains strong in other respects. And then at the bottom of that paragraph, it says, surely this was the answer, self-knowledge. And this is when Bill started to understand, oh my gosh, I have a problem. Oh my gosh, like now I get it. I have an abnormal reaction to liquor. my will is strong when it as far as everything else, but I have an abnormal reaction to liquor. This is great news. I understand now. Well, you know what they say about self-knowledge? It avails us nothing, right? And then he proceeds to learn his lesson. But it was not, for the frightful day came when I drank once more. Alcohol was my master. That is another, as he's trying to quit drinking, as after he swore it off forever, goes through all these, like the doctor's opinion just said, these, that circle eight of over and over and over again. No words can tell the loneliness. I'm at the top of page eight, first paragraph. No words can tell the loneliness and despair I found in that bitter morass of self-pity. This is so dramatic. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I have been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master. And as dramatic as that sounds with Bill's writing, I completely identify with that. Trembling, I step from my hospital, a broken man. Fear sobered me up for a bit. And who else has been sobered up for a bit by fear? Me, I actually got here based on fear. I came out of fear, I stay out of love, right? I came out of fear of King Alcohol and I stay out of love for Alcoholics Anonymous. Fear sobered me up for a bit. Then came the insidious insanity of what? Of that first drink. Not the insane things that I do while drinking. And I don't know how many of you guys have been in a meeting where insanity has been like the topic or whatever, and it's an open discussion meeting, and you start hearing about all of these insane things that people do when they're drunk. And it's like, that is not a qualification for alcohol. Like, yeah, okay, you jumped off the bridge naked, you know, in the middle of winter, whatever, but how much did you drink? Oh, really? After two cases or a fifth of tequila? I think anybody would be drunk enough to do those things. Like, that just comes with drunkenness. Like, you put as much alcohol in someone else's body as we put in our body, and we all do stupid stuff. I mean, that's just the effect produced by alcohol, right? And so college party drinking, you do some pretty insane stuff, even if you're not alcoholic. The insanity is that I took that drink, that first drink, completely sober, knowing what happens when I drink. The insanity is what precedes that first drink. So the insanity is the fact that I drink when I know I can't drink. The top of the page, nine, rumor had it that he had been committed for what? Not insanity, alcoholic insanity, right? Because this book makes very specific that it's not just about insanity. This is about alcoholic insanity. Normal in every respect, except for where alcohol is concerned, is what the pages we've read so far say. Second paragraph up from the bottom of the page, it's talking about after Ebby came to visit him, and he looked amazed, like, oh, Ebby's no longer a drunk. Like, he's got this glow, right? He's got this shine. And he says, well, what's the matter? Like, what happened to you? And he's like, well, I've found religion. I found God. I've been restored to sanity. And so now Bill's like, oh, I was aghast. So that was it. Last summer, a crackpot. Nope, not a crackpot. An alcoholic crackpot, because it's about alcoholic insanity. So last summer, an alcoholic crackpot. Now I suspected a little cracked about religion. I like that. So we're going to get to Bill's first step. I'm trying to skim forward that blind faith. Oh no, we skipped Bill's first step. Oh my gosh, how did I do that? Let's go back to page five. I apologize. Okay, sorry about that. Let's go back to page five real quick. I woke up. This had to be stopped. I saw that. Now, this is when Bill, this first paragraph is half of Bill's first step, the physical part, the powerlessness over alcohol, the physical part of the first step. But remember, there's two parts to the first step. And the second paragraph is going to be the second part of his first step. So he says, I woke up, this had to be stopped. I saw that I could not take so much as one drink. Now he sees that he's powerless over any alcohol whatsoever, right? He's allergic. I was through forever. Before then, I had written lots of sweet promises. My wife happily observed that at this time I meant business, and so I did. And then the very next paragraph, the very next line, the very next words, shortly afterward, I came home drunk. There had been no fight. Where had been my high resolve? I simply didn't know. It hadn't even come to mind. Someone pushed a drink my way and I took it. Was I crazy? So now he's starting to think, oh no. So it's more than just physical allergy. Something else is way wrong because I swore it off forever. And what I love about that first paragraph, when he says, you know, I had written a lot of sweet promises, right? I believe that that is like denial. When you come home and maybe Lois says, how much have you had to drink? And he says, two. And he knows that he has not just had two, right? You're denying something, right? When I go into my kitchen and my daughter has a mouthful of cookies, her, you know, cookies hanging out of her mouth, her cheek is sticking out. She's got her hand behind her back and the cookie jar is open and she says nothing. I'm going to say, you know, you're denying, you know, damn well that you just took the last cookie out of the cookie jar, right? Like that is denial. Alcohol insanity is something entirely different than denial. And I don't like the way that we use the term in AA because it's not used in our literature. Alcoholic insanity is you can hook me up to the lie detector test and I will pass. I am never going to drink again. I get hooked up to the lie detector test and I do pass and I'm drunk the next day. That is insanity. I'm not denying how much I drank. I am insane. I believe it. I'm believing my lie, right? And so where it says, before then I had written lots of sweet promises, but my wife happily observed that this time I meant business, and so I did. So he's no longer just denying how much he drank to Lois. He's experiencing alcoholic insanity because he doesn't realize that he can't just stop. So shortly after her word, I came home drunk. That was his first, you know, the second half of his first step. Now he's realizing, oh no, there's something else the matter with me. I'm not just allergic. I can't put it down. What am I going to do? That's when Abby came to visit him. You know, he gave it a couple more tries. Abby came to visit him. And then we're going to get through these steps real quick. I'm just going to shotgun through them real quick. So, on page 11, there's a line right in the middle of the page that I want to just make sure that everybody understands our program of action, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, the entire program, chapters 2 through 12 is taken from Bill's story. Like Bill's story is the program. That's where we got it. That's where it was created, is Bill's experience. And so everything in the rest of the chapters can be reconciled with this. So in the middle of the page, there's a line that I have highlighted. It says, God has done for him what he cannot do for him, what he could not do for himself. You guys know where that is, right? Page 84 in the promises, in the ninth step promises, it says, page 84, God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Little bit below that, it says, it began to look as though religious people were right after all. Where's that? Well, on page 87, be quick to see where religious people are right. Like everything can be reconciled with Bill's story. Here's the solidification of Bill's first step. In the middle of the page, right below that first quote that I just offered about God having had done for him what he couldn't do for himself. Like myself, he had admitted complete defeat. Complete defeat. That's the first step. Admission of complete defeat. And they say that upon the admission of complete defeat, that's when the structure can be built. And so now we're going to start on the rest of Bill's steps. Step two is right in the middle of page 12, and it's in italics, actually. They make it really easy to find the steps in this book. It's in italics, and it says, "It was only a matter of being willing to believe in a power greater than myself. Nothing more was required of me to make my beginning." And obviously, we know that that's reconciled on page 47 in the second step. I saw that growth could start from that point upon a foundation of complete willingness, a foundation of complete willingness. So the foundation that we are to start building this arch with the cornerstone and the keystone and the arch, which we will walk through to freedom. The foundation has to be complete willingness. And that's where we get in Appendix 2, the spiritual experience, where it says willingness, open-minded, and honesty. Willingness, open-minded, and honesty. What it doesn't say is honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. How is an AA, by the way, it's in the basic text of Narcotics Anonymous, but nowhere is it in AA. We have the who, right? And every single time throughout this whole book, it's who. Willingness always has to come first. And whenever those three words are together in our literature, in Alcoholics Anonymous literature, it's always willingness first. Because how am I supposed to become open-minded and honest without becoming willing to be open-minded, without becoming willing to be honest, right? And I was told that I got here trying to figure out how to fix my life. Like for years, I'm trying to figure out, how do I quit drinking? How do I get my life in order? How? And I get here and you guys tell me, nah, it's not how. There's one and he has all power. And that one is who, right? God. Let go and let God. I don't need to figure it out. I don't need to figure out how. It's who. That's the question in Alcoholics Anonymous. We're not a self-help program. We're a God help program. And so that's just my little pet peeve of mine, because I hear that word how a lot. And I'm like, ugh, so much stuff has made it in from other 12-step fellowships. It's like, that's what I'm talking about. Our literature preserving the integrity of the AA message, right? If it's not in the literature, disregard it. Even if you've heard it in the meetings 50 times. So at the top of page 13, I humbly offered myself to God. This is Bill's third step. So exciting. As I then understood him to do with me as he would, I placed myself unreservedly under his care and direction. I admitted for the first time that of myself, I was nothing. That without him, I was lost. I ruthlessly faced my sins and became willing, right? to have my newfound friend take them away, root and branch. I have not had a drink since. Holy crap. Awesome. So we not only went through the third step there, just if you guys are taking notes and highlighting and doing the geeky stuff like me, we also went through steps 4, 6, and 7. Say, let me read that again. I ruthlessly faced my sins, right? And became willing to have my newfound friend, God, take them away in step 7, right? Ruthlessly facing the sins in step 6. My schoolmate visited me, Ebby, which Bill considered his sponsor. So this is where Bill does his fifth step. And I fully acquainted him with my problems and deficiencies, right? We had to admit to another person, to God and to another person, the exact nature of our wrongs. That's step 5 right there. That's Bill's step 5. We made a list of people I had hurt, step 8, or toward whom I felt resentment. I expressed my entire willingness to approach these individuals, step 8, and individuals admitting my wrong. Never was I to be critical of them. I was to right all such matters to the utmost of my ability, step 9. I was to test my thinking by new God consciousness within. Common sense would thus become uncommon sense. I was to sit quietly when in doubt, asking only for direction and strength to meet my problems as he would have me be. you guys know what step this is. Step 11, never was I to pray for myself, except as my requests bore on my usefulness to others. Another reconciliation on page 87. Page 87, it says, we ask especially for freedom from self-will and are careful to make no requests for ourselves only. We may ask for ourselves, however, if others could be helped. That's in our 11th step in our big book, which we got directly from Bill's 11th step in his story. Then only might I accept to receive, but that I would be in great measure. You know what? I'm going to go ahead and stop there because it is getting a little bit. We will continue on Bill's 12th step because it's kind of a big one next week, and I'll open it up for questions.
Perfect. Thank you, Kerry. Thank you so much from everybody in the room. Just a quick reminder to everybody that this is a two-way consent state, so no, all questions have to come through the chat. We've only had 4 or 5 questions so far, please everyone get your thinking caps on and send me through chat, I'm your host, any questions that you may have. So I'm just going to start off with the ones that I have just now. So Carrie, how much time do you spend on average getting a newcomer through step one?
Let's see, about 2 hours to 2 months. And the reason I answer like that is because if someone asks for my help and they're dying of alcoholism, then, I mean, let's get going. We can revisit this stuff later. I'm not going to take them through the appendix and the foreword to the, you know, second edition of the big book by any stretch of the imagination. However, when somebody comes to me with, you know, already with good sobriety and a good amount of time, and even, you know, more sobriety time than me, then I would imagine she's asking me to sponsor her because past sponsorship hasn't been sufficient, or she's trying to learn something from me. So we start on the cover page and we go very slowly through it. And then there's 100 different examples I could give you between the two.
Awesome. Thank you, Kerry. Second question, and we still need more questions, please, ladies and gentlemen. So send in your questions, please. So the second one is, the big book says we have one symptom in common, the phenomenon of craving. Don't we also share the symptom of the mental obsession, the fact that we can't stay away from the first drink?
What a great question. Yes. But no matter what, the alcoholic and the potential alcoholic shares the phenomenon of craving. So later on, and we'll get to this on page 21, but later on, so Bill talks about the potential alcoholic. And I was at another workshop where somebody asked me, what is the potential alcoholic? Is that somebody who just isn't alcoholic yet? And it's like, well, I've been taught that being alcoholic is like being pregnant, right? Like you either are or you're not. You don't develop alcoholism. And so, somebody who's only 2 months pregnant isn't showing a lot of signs. She's not going to walk into the room and you're going to go, oh my gosh, she's pregnant. You know, she's early on in her development. And alcoholism for me is once you are beyond human aid, once your alcoholism, the mind, the crux of the problem has progressed to where you can't stop on your own willpower, then that's when you're alcoholic. But a potential alcoholic could still be just, I mean, you know, have the phenomenon of craving. And I believe that's an alcoholic. That's not, they don't categorize that as a non-alcoholic. They categorize it as a potential alcoholic, which means you're alcoholic, but right now you can probably stop on your own because you're not beyond human aid, you know, you're not beyond human aid yet.
Perfect. I was born an alcoholic. Dot dot dot. True? Question mark. I am a mild alcoholic.
Well, I love.
He finishes it off with, "I am a mild alcoholic?" Question mark.
Okay. All right. So, for a few years before I had the respect that I have today in our literature, because I didn't always respect our literature. I thought I could write it better. I used to identify myself whenever I would go to tell my story or when I was asked to speak somewhere. I used to say I'm an alcoholic. I still do sometimes say I always have been and I always will be. And I'm trying to get out of that habit. It's a hard habit to break because I've been doing it for so long. But what I used to consider myself as is I was born this way. Like I even had a shirt that says born this way. There's not a single non-alcoholic on my dad's side of the family. I tried for years to be the first non-alcoholic on my dad's side of the family. However, whether that's true or false, that scientific stuff, that has nothing to do with anything that our literature confirms in Alcoholics Anonymous. So whether scientifically that's true or false, great, but unfortunately it's considered an outside issue in Alcoholics Anonymous, and nowhere does our literature say that alcoholism is genetic. So until, you know, science may one day prove that and we adopt that conception into our literature, which it hasn't, then I don't get to offer my opinion on that. So, and what was the next dot, dot, dot? What was the next one that it was dot, dot, dot?
It was, I was born an alcoholic, dot, 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 true, question mark. I am a mild alcoholic, question mark.
Yeah, mild alcoholic, great, yeah. So, I'll share my own experience. I became probably physically addicted to alcohol when I was 22 years old, and it became scary because I thought that's what an alcoholic was. I didn't know there was such a huge difference, like night and day, between alcoholism and addiction. I didn't know that because none of our literature is about addiction. Well, there's tons of other 12-step fellowships for addiction. I didn't know what an alcoholic was. And so I started thinking, oh my God, I'm becoming an alcoholic because I'm physically addicted. I'm becoming dependent on this alcohol. And so, because of my alcoholic tendencies, once I start drinking, I can't stop. I was already an alcoholic, but I didn't have that physical or I didn't have that mental obsession yet. I wasn't beyond human aid. And because I was getting scared that I was becoming physically addicted, I made the decision on a New Year's resolution to quit drinking for a year to prove that I wasn't, you know, alcoholic. And I did. And it wasn't a problem. I didn't have to change the people I was hanging out with. I didn't have to change, you know, because I just knew that once I took a drink, I couldn't stay stopped. And so I knew that I couldn't just cut down on alcohol. That was obvious. That was obvious from me from the get. Like, you know, if I wasn't an alcoholic when I was born, as soon as I took a drink, an alcoholic was born. And that's a fact because I've never had a normal relationship with alcohol. I've always had an abnormal relationship with alcohol. I've never drank with impunity. I don't know what that is. But as far as crossing that line into being needing God's help instead of human power, I had human power. My ism hadn't gotten out of control, and I actually stopped for a year. Now, I had the bonus prize at the end of knowing that once that year was over, I could drink however I wanted because I was not an alcoholic. And I could tell you, especially toward the end of the year, how many days left of the year, 23 days, 22 days, 20, you know, but no, I could stop, you know, I hadn't crossed that threshold. I hadn't crossed that line of being without human aid. Like human aid was fine for me at one point.
Excellent. So, good question. Recovered versus recovering. Please explain.
Well, I love this one because I don't have to offer any of my own opinion because the big book explains that so beautifully over and over and over and over and over and over and over again. Actually, you can't get through a single chapter without seeing the word recovered. But I think that there's no better place to explain what a recovered alcoholic is than the definition on page, and we're not there yet, so I hate to skip ahead, but you guys, 10th step promises, is that 85? Yeah, 84 and 85. So 84 and 85, the 10th step promises that do not happen as a result of sitting in the meeting for 90 days, that do not come materialize because we graduated treatment. They materialize as a result of working everything up until page 84, right? And then by that time, Sanity will have returned. We will seldom be interested in liquor. I don't know about you guys, but when I first got here, I was not seldom interested in liquor. If tempted, we recoil as if from a hot flame. I had never recoiled from alcohol as if from a hot flame before I recovered. We react sanely and normally. I did not act sanely and normally. And we will feel that this has happened automatically. We see that our whole new attitude toward people, places, and things. Oops, so sorry, it doesn't say that. Toward liquor, because this isn't a program of Al-Anon family groups. It's Alcoholics Anonymous. We see that our new attitude toward liquor has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. Now, I spent a lot of time before I was a recovered alcoholic staying away from alcohol. Like, it was almost a full-time job not drinking. You know, it was like, what are you doing today, Carrie? I'm staying home, not drinking. Like, it was really a full-time job. I'm staying away from people, places, and things that might make me drink. Like, that's a non-recovered alcoholic. And then the recovered alcoholic, after doing the work, experiences a miracle. The book uses the word miracle. It says, that is the miracle of it. We are not fighting it, neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we've been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We have not even sworn it off. Instead, the problem has been removed, recovered. It does not exist for us.
Thank you, Carrie.
And I'll just add an example that I was given that helped me to understand recovered was, I mean, I'll never be able to drink with impunity. Obviously, I am allergic, right? That's the one thing we all have in common. But if the real crux of the problem is up here, then up here is what I need to recover from. I need a spiritual solution. And I love 12-step. I love 12-step. I love messy wet work. I love fighting with a drunk. Like, I could not tell you guys, seriously, like, my old hobby would be to sit with, you know, a drink in and watch on the TV the red carpets. And I was all about who's dating who in Hollywood. I have no clue what's going on in Hollywood today. I could not tell you when the last time I even glanced at the red carpets is, but my favorite thing to do today is to fight with a wet drunk. And I have been bitten, pissed on, and puked on. And there's nothing I'd rather do than be part of a newly, you know, a spiritual awakening, or to be part of that first encounter into Alcoholics Anonymous and to help another alcoholic. Now, because of that, I don't drive the nicest cars, right? Because I've had accidents in my cars. And so I drive a piece of crap, and my piece of crap car, my last one, now I'm going to do a new piece of crap car. I left my other one on the side of the road when it finally dumped. I paid somebody to go get it and thrash it. But I actually had a couple of sponsees and grand sponsee in the car with me for that one. That was fun. And it was on the freeway. So anyway, I'm on to the next car now. And that car, you know, it took a crap, and I brought it into the auto mechanic, and they're like, well, the engine is gone, right? Like, you need it replaced or rebuilt, one of the two. So it's like, okay, I don't like know anything about cars, so do what you got to do. Well, when I drove out of the parking lot after they recovered my engine, it was recovered. It was 100% recovered. But they warned me, if I don't keep up on the maintenance, if I don't continue to get oil changes and put gas in it and rotate tires, then I'm going to be screwed again, right? So just because I was shot with a gun and that bullet wound like is healed doesn't make me bulletproof. It just makes that gunshot recovered. I can't, you know, play with guns. I probably should try not to play with guns. But that's the difference between, you know, and that maintenance is the key. And if it was just about recovering and graduating after we work, steps 1 through 9 is what, how I recover, right? But it's not a 9-step program. It's a 12-step program. And those last 3 steps, that's the maintenance that I have to continue to do to keep in fit spiritual condition, or I will get sick again. The insanity of alcohol, and this is a big quote of the insanity of alcohol, will return and I will drink again. So the maintenance is the key for me.
And me. Thank you, Carrie. Do all sponsors take their sponsees through the book in this way? If not, why?
Well, that's not really a question I can answer out of the literature. I guess I can, according to the questions and answers on sponsorship. You know, there's no right way or no wrong way to do it. It doesn't matter who's right in AA. It matters who's left. That's my joke. But I would have, about 5 years ago, I would have told you, yeah, and they're wrong. The big book is the only way. It's our directions. But honestly, like, you know, today when somebody asks me to sponsor them, because there's a wrench for every nut, and I don't like most AA sayings that don't come out of the book. That one I actually really like. There's a wrench for every nut. And thank God that I'm not for everybody, because ain't nobody got time for that, right? So I explain that there's a whole bunch of different ways for sponsorship, and I do this with my hands. I see lots of women I sponsor in the room nodding. Yes, I've seen this. But like there's a sponsorship line over here that will like tell you, keep your legs closed for 90 days. We don't date in the first year, sit in the front row, text, check in with me at every, you call me at 7:01 every night, blah, blah, blah. You know, that works for some people. I would have talked crap about that a few years ago, but that works for some people. It does. I've seen it work. It wouldn't work for me, but it does work for some people. And then there's the opposite sponsorship line over here. And they're like, if it doesn't say it in the big book, then it's not part of the recovery, right? And then there's everything in between, which I have one in between. It's like, well, yeah, it doesn't say it in the big book, but it does say it in Comes of Age. You know, all of our literature, more has been revealed. We have adopted other principles since the big book was written, blah, 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 right? So there's all these different sponsorship lines from one extreme to the next. And I see them all working for some people. And the only thing I've seen that doesn't work is when the newcomer cherry picking, loophole finding, ego ran like I was, decides, well, I like what this sponsorship line has to offer. And then I like this part of this one, and I'll take this out of this. And that is what rarely works. So I usually, after I get done with my spiel of somebody who, you know, wants me to sponsor them, I get done with my spiel as far as what I do and what I don't do. And if they're still in the room, which most of the time they're probably not, because I'm not the easier, softer way. Then I also hand them three additional phone numbers of women who do things a little different than me. And there's no wrong, you know, and that's okay too.
Good stuff. Thank you, Carrie. It's the usual question that we ask every time. Would you be willing to stay on afterwards to answer the rest of the questions?
Yes, 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 of course.
Excellent. Thank you. Okay. Well, thank you, Carrie. It's been an absolutely wonderful, 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 wonderful workshop. For those who care, please join me in closing with a moment of silence for those still sick and suffering inside and outside of the rooms, followed by the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. Thank you very much, Carrie. The next question. How do you take a sponsee through step 2 and 3 when they have anger towards their current higher power?
When they have anger toward what?
Their current higher power.
Oh, well, we'll probably get to that, not next week, but the week after. I don't know. Dee, do you guys want me answering questions that are ahead of where we are? I'd like to save the questions for first step when we're on, but I'll answer it. You know, it's really hard to answer this without going to page 63, but there's directions for that. I mean, there's directions for that in the book, and I have to trust the process. So in step 1, if someone's angry toward their higher power and they don't have willingness, I have to trust the process that if we're going through this book thoroughly, By the time we get there, then something might have shifted. And by the time we get to pre-3, which is whole 2.5 pages, and I don't know if you guys, you know, and again, we'll get there in a couple of weeks. I'll give you a little preview of pre-3. So there's only one of the places in the whole book, most of the time where we're starting on a step, it'll say in italics, this brings us to step 10, or step 11 suggests, or the whole chapter is devoted to step 12, and it's all in italics. Step 3 is the only place in the whole book that it says 2 times. Once it says, being convinced we are at step 3, and that's in italics. And then 2.5 pages later, it says, we are now at step 3. Everything between those two statements is pre-3, and that's to get us ready for taking step 3. Because underneath step 3, it says, we thought well before taking this step, making sure we were ready, that we could at last abandon ourselves utterly to him. Those are some pretty, that's a pretty big pill to swallow, you know? And so that takes a little bit of getting ready. And all the entire, every word of what goes on between those two pages, being convinced we're at step 3, is what prepares us to actually take step 3, is what prepares us to actually be ready to take step 3. Like, yeah, I'm convinced I'm at step 3 because I'm done with my second step, right? Well, okay, but just what do we mean by that? And just what do we do? That is exactly what this paragraph says. And it actually asks those questions. Just what do we mean by that? And just what do we do? Well, the first requirement, not suggestion, because this is a suggested program full of requirements, not a required program full of suggestions. The first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self can be hardly be a success. And it starts going from there on kind of talking the prospect into why they don't really have a choice. So we'll get there when we get there. Ross, I think you're muted.
I'm talking to myself. Sorry.
Oh, okay. I do that too.
When you're not sure, when you're sure the person is not an alcoholic, how do you proceed, or do you proceed?
Ooh, love this question. It's a 12-step question, and we're definitely not to 12, step 12, but I will make an exception because the 12th step is someone else's first step, and the first step is someone else's 12th step. And so I love the clear-cut directions in Chapter 7, Working with Others, and it says, if I'm satisfied that he's a real alcoholic, and you'll hear in the rooms all this stuff, how, oh, well, we don't qualify others. We don't, BS. In the big book, it says that when somebody asks me to help them, I don't qualify you, you know, Joe Blow, who's sitting in the meeting. Like, I don't take your inventory if you're sitting in the meeting. But when you ask me for help, that is spiritual consent. And I have a spiritual, not just right, responsibility to make sure you're an alcoholic before I proceed with this stuff. And the big book says, I mean, we are killing people in Alcoholics Anonymous. There are heroin addicts that have never had a problem with alcohol, dying in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, overdosing in on drugs because we are so filled with ego and arrogance that we think we can help save the world. And Bill wrote a lot about that. He wrote a lot about that. And so I have to make sure that I believe that they're a real alcoholic. Now, you don't even have to believe that you're a real alcoholic. I don't get to tell you if you're an alcoholic or not. I don't get to tell you you're not an alcoholic or you are. I just get to qualify you within myself. And that is the determining factor whether we proceed or not after the first step. So what that looks like is if I'm talking to someone who is not an alcoholic, but they say, oh, yeah, no, I'm willing to call myself an alcoholic. It's all the same thing. And so I'll just transfer my addiction to alcoholism so that I can stay in the rooms of AA. And I'm like, okay, well, first, let's find out if you are, because some people come in, they don't know they're an alcoholic. They think they're just drug addict, but let's dig in. You know, let's uncover and discover and discard your old idea about how you are not powerless over alcohol, right? And I have helped to qualify many people who believe that they are not alcoholic, and it turns out they are. Well, let's look at the other extreme, where you are not an alcoholic, but you're like, yeah, well, it's all the same thing. No, I don't like liquid alcohol because, you know, it makes me sick. I don't like the taste. I don't like the feeling. But once I start snorting coke, I can't stop. Right. So it's like, okay, well, what happens when you do drink? Like, I know you don't like it, but what happens when you're at a party, there's no coke, and you do start drinking? Well, I usually give it away or leave it and go find coke. Okay. So I'm going to help you to, you know, we don't help everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous, but we can help to find them the help they need. So I go with them. I don't just point to the door. I go with them to Cocaine Anonymous, to Heroin Anonymous, to Narcotics Anonymous, to Overeaters Anonymous, to Gambling Anonymous. And the reason I'm going down this list is because these are all rooms that I have personally been to with lost non-alcoholics, because my job is not to just be of maximum service to alcoholics, it's to be of maximum service to God and those about me. And just because I can't help an alcoholic does not mean I can't help, as an Alcoholics Anonymous member in AA, does not mean that I can't help them to find the help they need outside of AA. Now, let's flip the situation. Somebody who doesn't think they're alcoholic, right? Somebody who's swearing up and down, I am not alcoholic. I have a little bit of a drinky poo problem, but I'm not alcoholic. Well, I'm not going to tell them that they are. It's not my job to do that. But I'm going to ask them the same questions. Okay, so what happens when you go out to have two drinks? Well, sometimes I can. Okay, but what happens when you go out to have two drinks and you don't? Have you ever been drunk? Well, yeah, sometimes I'll change my mind when I get to the bar. Oh, you change your mind. You know, and again, so did you change your mind and decide only to have one drink? The answer has never been yes so far. Well, no. I just changed my mind because, you know, I get in the mood to have more. Okay, so they're talking about the phenomenon of craving. I don't need to point that out to them. But I, you know, and okay, have you ever tried to quit drinking before? Well, yeah, multiple times. But I changed my mind. Oh, you've changed your mind. Okay. So yeah, maybe you're not alcoholic. I don't know. Let's go through the work anyways, you know, because now I'm satisfied that they're a real alcoholic. They don't need to be satisfied. If I'm satisfied, like it says in the big book, that he's a real alcoholic, then I can begin to dwell on the hopelessness and futility, is what the big book says, of, you know, the spiritual condition. And that's where I get to introduce, you know, that stuff. But before I'm satisfied that they're not, if they're not a real alcoholic and I'm not satisfied and they've just told me pretty much that they don't even have a drinking problem in the least, then it's arrogance and ego and nothing else. And I was there. I sponsored a lot of non-alcoholics in the beginning of my sobriety, ones that I regret to this day. And this is part of the reason why I'm doing this as a living amends.